Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Larry Tighe, who has written a fascinating new biography of Superman.
Superman will continue to defy the 15 minutes of fame that most everybody else in the world gets.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The unusual work of Sheila Hedy. Is it fiction or is it memoir?
I think the book, you know, really is an attempt to answer the question that the title poses, or at least to ask that question over and over again.
Vanity Fair's Bruce Handy talks about his fabulous, boring book collection.
It seemed like it's self-negating in a way, you know, like Hope for Man. Like, what hope does man have if he needs a book called Hope for Man, if that makes sense?
And Greg Coles has bestseller news.
Than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman.
Well, in these days of declining Americanism, our superpower status seeming to ebb away, what better hero to look to than Superman? And there's an important new book on that very subject. It's called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. It's by Larry Tighe, and it's reviewed on our cover by James Parker, who says it's an engaging book filled with potent descriptions of some of the extraordinary characters behind this creation. I'm delighted that Larry Tighe is joining us on the phone to talk about his book. Welcome, Larry, and congratulations.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Okay, the story of Superman has been told once or twice, but it's just so remarkable. Walk us through the origins of the greatest of all superheroes.
So I'd like to take you back to the 1930s in a very poor part of Cleveland, Ohio, called Glenville, that was about 98% Jewish. And a guy named Jerry Siegel, a teenager named Jerry Siegel, was perpetually being teased. And he'd go out to the playground during school, and they would yell, "Siegel, Siegel, birds of an eagle," and he would wish that he could fly away. And so every night when he'd go to bed, he'd bring a pencil and paper with him, and he would think about what it would be like if he had superpowers and could actually fly away or basically fight back against the bullies. And he devised at one point this extraordinary character named The Super Hyphen Man, and it was a bad guy, and it was a guy who was very powerful, but he struck back at his enemies and he wanted to take over the world. And this was the Superman, as Jerry would have it, for the first few years when he was writing this. And then one day something happened that transformed his life and his hero. His dad, Michael Siegel, owned a haberdashery, and three guys walked in, tried on a suit, and walked out without paying. And Michael went after them, and he had a massive heart attack, and he died. And suddenly, for Jerry, who was the youngest of six children of Lithuanian Jewish immigrants, suddenly his hero, who started out as a bad guy, became a good guy. And in the first drawing that his buddy Joe Schuster ever did of this hero, Superman was sweeping in to rescue a man who looked suspiciously like Michael, who was being robbed. So basically, Superman came from a bereft boy who needed a hero, and he came to America at the moment where we might have needed a hero more than any time in our history, which was in the middle of the Great Depression and on the eve of World War II.
Okay, Larry, you've given us a great deal here. Let's try to unpack it a little bit. So what we're beginning with, first of all, is really the fantasy that many young boys have, that they could be stronger and faster and beat up the bullies and impress everyone and remake themselves into these godlike figures. So we have these two teenagers now who translate this universal impulse into a real idea. What happened next? How did it become a comic book?
What happened was they were just starting to try out the form of comic books. Historically, the big thing in the comic world was the comic strips that ran in newspapers. And a guy named Major Wheeler Nicholson was trying out the idea of running unique copy that appeared for the first time in this format of a comic book. And he was looking around for anybody he could find that would fill his pages. And he found Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, these two young boys, and he ran several of their features, and he was about to run their Superman feature when he went into bankruptcy, and two old pornographers named Harry Donenfeld and Jack Leibowitz came along, bought out Major Nicholson's assets, the company that would go on to become DC Comics, and they decided to try out, on the cover of their first issue, this great new hero, Superman. They had very low hopes for it, and so did Jerry and Joe, and yet, for the next 10 or 12 issues, every time they would put Superman back on the cover, it would sell out at the newsstands, sell hundreds of thousands of copies in a way that comic books had never done. And so it was basically on Superman's muscle-bound back, not just that this first issue of these new comics took flight, but the whole idea of superheroes.
And what happened to the creators? I mean, this is not the happiest of stories.
Well, I call it the original sin of comic books, because Harry and Jack, these two guys who had bought DC Comics, paid Jerry and Joe the grand total of $130 for the rights to Superman Forever. And the good news for the guys was that their comic book, that their hero, saw publication, and that they were hired to do the drawing and writing of him. The bad is that they gave up the rights to a character that would earn billions of dollars for, again, that grand total of $130.
And was that something they simply could not challenge legally?
It was something that two kids who were in their early 20s and had been trying for years to get somebody to publish them, they were partly outsmarted by Harry and Jack, but they were just in a desperate situation. And they would have taken, if they had said, we want the rights for nothing, Jerry and Joe would have done it, because their hero finally was making a success of itself.
Now, Larry, my colleagues and I at the Book Review are editors. Some of us write as well. Some of us write books, but we're editors primarily. And there is a remarkable editor described in your book. Tell us about Mort Weisinger, if I've pronounced his name right.
You pronounced it right. And in the 1960s, Mort Weisinger was basically Superman's super editor. He was in charge of all the writers and all the illustrators and all the editors who were putting Superman into publication. And he decided that a lot of comic books in the 1960s were like the rest of America in the 1960s, trying to get topical and trying to talk about everything from race to the early days of the Vietnam War to things that were going on in the world. Mort Weisinger was a very conservative guy, and he was a very brusque guy, and he was a dictator in terms of what went on at DC Comics then. And he decided the best thing for Superman was to stay out of reality and was to create what he called imaginary stories. And the idea of calling anything, when you're talking about a comic book to begin with, you know, it was as if all the other stories weren't imaginary. But he decided that he was going to have his Superman get married, and he was going to have his Superman die at one point. And he would do all of these special adventures that he decided what kids wanted in that era was to be as far away from reality as possible. And he took them there, and it worked for nearly the whole decade of the 1960s. Nobody who worked for him liked him, but everybody understood that he was selling comic books and that he was the boss, and they had to do what he said.
And where are we now with Superman? I know a new, very young generation is still enthralled by him, the Fortress of Solitude and all the rest. Is this just an enduring, permanent part of American culture?
We are now at 74 years and counting, and I think if he does the two things that he's done so brilliantly throughout the first 74 years, he'll be around for another 74. And those are partly to evolve with the times. You know, when he started out, he was a great New Deal liberal. In the war era, he was the guy who helped take us to war. And every era, he changed just enough to sort of make him feel somewhat contemporary. That was half of his success. The other half was to stay true to the core of who he was, which was a Dudley Do-Right kind of character who was all about making us see within ourselves somebody who could just aspire to bigger things and do right. And I think if he does those two things, Superman will continue to defy the 15 minutes of fame that most everybody else in the world gets.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Thank you very much.
That's Larry Tai, whose new book, Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So the great Hemingway is not only still with us, but getting kind of bigger, at least one of his novels is.
He is. One of his most beloved novels, A Farewell to Arms, is being released in a new edition next week. And what makes this new edition special is that it includes all of the alternate endings that Hemingway wrote and preserved.
So we're talking about, what, three or four different cracks he took at it?
Many more than that. It turns out there are 47 alternate endings that we know of anyway. And these were referred to by Hemingway in a 1958 Paris Review interview. George Plimpton sat down with Hemingway and they were talking about the writing of A Farewell to Arms. And Plimpton asked him, you know, about the writing process, and Hemingway said, well, I rewrote the ending 39 times before I was satisfied. Well, it turns out when one of Hemingway's grandsons went back, looked at all of the archival materials, he decided that there were 47 endings.
Where are the archival materials, by the way?
They are in Boston at the John F. Kennedy Library.
So his grandson, Sean, is that his name?
Yes, one of his grandsons. But this particular grandson has a great interest. He's one of the managers of the estate. He is actually a curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York.
So this new edition will include all the variant endings. Now, to be fair, it's not as if these are endings that take up as many pages as, say, the last volume of Remembrance of Things Past, right? Some of these are quite short.
Right. Some of them are very short. Some of them are not all that different from the actual endings. But then you get into the endings that are quite different. And the way that they've been labeled by Hemingway scholars, one of them is, I believe, titled The Live Baby Ending. And I don't think I need to tell our listeners that this is a spoiler alert, but the baby in the book actually does die at the end. So it would be quite a change and leave the reader with a much more optimistic note to end the novel with the baby surviving.
Now, do you have your story does quote a couple of the endings. Can you read one or two aloud to us?
Sure. One of the endings is called the Nada ending. Hemingway wrote, quote, "That is all there is to the story. Catherine died, and you will die, and I will die, and that is all I can promise you."
Gee, thanks, Ernest. Now, there was one that F. Scott Fitzgerald preferred. Is that right?
He did.
His frenemy F. Scott Fitzgerald?
Yes. They apparently exchanged a lot of their notes and a lot of their pages while they were writing. And this ending is referred to quite simply as the Fitzgerald ending. And it goes, quote, "It kills the very good and very gentle and the very brave impartially. If you are none of these, you can be sure it will kill you too, but there will be no special hurry." End quote.
I kind of like that one, except tonally, it's been a long time since I've read A Farewell to Arms, but tonally they do sound a little different, a little more preachy maybe than the classic Hemingway. Now, Julie, he had very celebrated editor Maxwell Perkins, also Fitzgerald's editor. Do we know what the process was here? Did Hemingway say, okay, Max, here's 47 of them. Which one do you like? Or was it Hemingway endlessly revising, trying to get it, hit the right note, and then thinking, aha, I've got it?
Well, from what we know of from the historical record, Hemingway really didn't use his editor in a very active way. He wrote what he wrote. He didn't like a lot of interference from his publisher. So our understanding of what happened is that he wrote the ending that he eventually decided on. It was just after a lot of revisions. One thing that I think is very interesting about this is, you know, would we have this kind of historical artifact anymore? You know, our great novelists of today, certainly very few of them write in longhand. When they want to change something, they just press backspace and delete it. And I think one thing that makes this very special and very interesting is just the ability to see a little bit into what the writer was thinking.
You know, it's an interesting point, though, Julia. I remember reading, I think maybe it was in James Atlas's biography of Bello, or maybe an interview Bello gave, that his papers, which I believe at that point, I don't know if they still are, at the University of Chicago, included all the documentation for Humboldt's Gift, one of his classics. And I think it's something like a total of 5,000 pages of manuscript. And each time through, he would actually rewrite the novel start to end. Do we really know that contemporary novelists don't, in the end, work the same way? Which is to say, you write your ending, print it out, maybe it's not there, you set it aside, and then write another one? Or are we getting the impression from our novelists that they really do use the computer to write in a different way?
I think just by virtue of the way that the technology works nowadays, like, it's almost impossible to have the same records that we did when, you know, in the 20s when Hemingway was producing so much of his work. I think that there are novelists nowadays who do kind of try to keep a bit more of a record. Certainly there are some that keep handwritten notes. We have, you know, a lot of back and forth between writer and editor, but nothing could rival what we have from the novelists from earlier in the 20th century.
And we probably don't have a lie documentation, at least as voluminously or copiously as we once did, like letters, for instance. The long, detailed letters these great writers would send to friends and fellow writers and editors, or is that shrinking too, isn't it?
Well, there's probably a lot more output. It's just shorter. It's an email. It's not as well-crafted and well thought out. So we do have a lot of records. It's just taken on very different forms. And one thing that Patrick Hemingway, who's Hemingway's only surviving son at this point. He's 84 years old. He lives in Montana. And I spoke to him for this story, and he said that while he thinks that the new edition does give insight into what his father was thinking, he really believes that it's true that no matter how much you analyze a classic bit of writing, you can still never really figure out what makes talent work.
I'm sure he's right, but now I imagine the collected tweets of Samuel Beckett. The problem is, I don't know if he could fill out the 140 characters each time.
It would be a challenge.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
As novel and memoir fuse, it seems, at times, into a single form, one writer has emerged as a really original perpetrator of it, we'll call her. Her name is Sheila Hetty. Her new book is called How Should a Person Be? It's reviewed for us by David Haglund of Slate, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, David.
Hi, Sam.
Okay, so she's an unusual, talented person. What's she up to?
Well, it's hard to say. She's doing something I haven't really seen done before, which is take her own life and not exactly fictionalize it so much as open it up to readers so that she can ask the questions she wants to ask through her writing. I think the book, you know, really is an attempt to answer the question that the title poses, or at least to ask that question over and over again. So she does this by recording conversations with friends and transcribing them. Much of the book is dialogue. I wouldn't say you ever get an answer, but you certainly just sort of turn that question over and over again in your mind until the book's over.
So she is doing something original or new with the form, which is not an easy thing to do. And how long has she been writing books like this?
I don't think she's ever written a book like this. Her previous books, she wrote a novel called Ticknor, which it actually touches on similar themes about art and rivalry and friendship, but in a totally different way. It's a more familiar form. It's experimental in its way, but in a manner that I think readers who have read European novels, say, from the last 50 years would recognize. Whereas this one is really nothing like that. It's much shaggier. It's very conversational. She also published a collection of stories called The Middle Stories, which are these riffs on fairy tales. And they're both enjoyable books, but really very little like this one.
She's a good writer.
Yes, she's excellent. And I think one of the interesting things about looking at those previous books is you get a sense for her control of prose, which you wouldn't necessarily, that wouldn't be how you'd describe this one, I don't think, if you picked it up without having read her previous books. Because in a way, I think she lets the prose get away from her sort of deliberately. There are parts that are very romantic almost. There's a sort of sexual fantasy about this man that she gets involved with, in which the writing kind of is carried along by, you know, by desire, essentially.
Is it possible to summarize the story such as it is in this novel?
The closest I think it could come would be to say it's about her friendship with a painter named Margot, and about the tension that arises as the two of them try to work out their, you know, separate artistic projects. I mean, that doesn't really do it justice. There are other friends. There's this man, Israel is his name.
That's the one she's involved with.
That's the one she's involved with. And I think that name, I mean, many of the characters take their names from real life. Margot is Margot Williamson, a painter who's a friend of Sheila Hetty's. I don't know if Israel is based on a real man, if his name is Israel. It's a very loaded name, obviously. And the book is concerned with Jewish identity as well as identity more generally. So that doesn't seem coincidental. But
is she Jewish?
I believe she is, yeah. Yeah.
David, when someone writes in this way, with this, you say, whether or not it's evident in this particular novel, enormous control of the language in her sentences and such, and raises questions and ambiguities in the reader's mind, that's also part of what she's doing, right?
Yes, completely. And I think that's much of the virtue of the novel, is the way that it challenges certain ideas about form and about the well-made novel that she really tosses out the window.
But David, you also say that she's opening her life up or opening these questions up to readers.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that readers answer or respond to them? Just through their engagement with the book, or does she really want people to be in contact with her?
It's a good question. She's really – I've never, you know, gone to a reading of hers, but I gather, you know, she has a striking kind of presence. She wrote this book with Misha Gluberman, who also appears in this book, called The Chairs Are Where the People Go, which is a kind of work of pop philosophy, essentially. And she does have an interest in sort of really engaging with people and trying to answer these kind of big questions. But the narrator's voice in this book is really unusual, in part because as an author, I think Hetty is being incredibly self-deprecating. The narrator, it comes off as very foolish at times, which seems like a brave thing to do when you're, you know, presenting a character who has your name and shares basically all of the key autobiographical traits with you. She doesn't seem to have any writerly vanity.
And how influential a figure is she becoming? James Wood, the great critic, wrote a fairly lengthy essay in The New Yorker, and you've written a substantial piece for us. Is she somebody to reckon with?
I think so. I mean, the reception of this book over the next few months will probably say a lot. There's been a lot of discussion of it. You mentioned The New Yorker review. Slate, where I work, also ran a long review of it. And it's shown up a lot online, particularly on sites like Jezebel and The Hairpin, which are specifically aimed toward women. I think that she's a striking figure in part because what she's doing breaks so much with what people expect from women writers in particular.
How so?
Well, she's so confessional. And like I said, it seems to have little vanity. So she's putting herself out there, putting her sexual desires out there in a very frank and sometimes almost troubling way. This guy Israel that she gets involved with in the book is really kind of domineering. And she responds to that very positively at first before ultimately rejecting him. So she seems willing to kind of bear that in a way that is unusual.
You're familiar with her, with a lot of her work. If someone wants to introduce him or herself to Sheila Hetty, is this the book to start with?
I think so. It's such an interesting point of entry into her mind that you start here and then, you know, go on to Ticknor and you see the way she's working through some of the same kinds of questions, but in a very different way in that book and likewise in The Middle Stories. But this is a very engaging book, I think, and very readable. As strange as it is, it's not daunting or intimidating at all.
Thanks so much, David.
Thanks, Sam.
That's David Haglund, who reviews How Should a Person Be by Sheila Hetty in this week's book review. I'm on record as having said that almost nothing I read, particularly in a journalism or books, makes me laugh out loud. I get amused and I'm impressed and there's a sort of quiet pleasure inside, but not much really makes me laugh. But my great friend, fantastic editor and writer, Bruce Handy, violates the rule. He made me laugh out loud with our back page essay titled My Fabulous Boring Book Collection. I'm delighted that Bruce is here to talk about it. Welcome, Bruce.
Oh, thanks, Sam. I guess it was the nicest intro I've ever had. Can we just stop now? I think I'm done. You know, that's a wrap.
Well, okay. So you really have been, you collect boring books. And what's the attraction of the boring book?
It's related to a particular cultural milieu because I live on the Upper West Side in Manhattan, and there's all these booksellers up and down Broadway who just, you know, sell their old books on
The sidewalk.
Yeah, right on the sidewalk. Basically, yeah, they set up card tables, and it's great. It's great kind of browsing. It's a little bit like New York's answer to the, you know, all the bookstalls along the Seine in Paris. I've always sort of enjoyed looking at these books, and one day I was walking along and browsing, and there was this sort of bright orange, pretty large size paperback book with Adlai Stevenson's face on it. It just said Stevenson's Speeches, and I was kind of thunderstruck by it because I you know, picked it up and looked at it, and it was just transcripts of his, you know, speeches. You know, he'd given a speech on labor policy in, you know, September of 1952 or something like that, you know, and there's this whole text, and you look at it and it's like, well, I'm, you know, so glad to be here in St. Louis, you know, go kart, you know, I mean, just all the, you know, all the boring preamble. And I was just struck. I just thought I could not imagine, like, who could possibly want to read this book in, you know, 2010 or whatever year it was. It just seemed like I just could not imagine a more boring book in a kind of profound way. I mean, obviously there's, you know, there's sort of books that are obscure or books for a very, you know, narrow audience. I mean, you see, again, on these booksellers, you know, you see a lot of old, you know, psychology textbooks or, you know, special interest stuff, you know, like the, you know, the Jewish approach to astrology, things like that. You know, I mean, they might be boring to me, but you can see that they have their audience. But this just seemed like
it nobody would want to read.
Yeah, it had this odd sort of resonance, this kind of purity of boredom that I just, you know, it just attracted me. And then I think the next one that I saw was this book Hope for Man. It was a written by a rabbi and kind of a sort of a popular philosopher from the 40s.
So, Bruce, this is Hope for Man by Joshua Loth Lieberman, published in 1966.
Yeah, it was a posthumous book of essays. But again, it just seemed like there's something about that title. It just seemed so deadening. It was the idea that, like, it seemed like it's self-negating in a way. You know, like, Hope for Man. Like, what hope does man have if he needs a book called Hope for Man, if that makes sense? And it just had this kind of like dreary font. Again, it was just like, what is this for? Who is the audience? I mean, I know what the audience was at the time, but now it just seems like this sort of lost, stranded thing just kind of, you know, sitting out there. And again, it just had this sort of purity to it that I thought. So that kind of got me started on this collection. And
well, what you say is they have to be really kind of sublimely boring. And
yes,
you've got some great examples here. Uma Thurman, the biography. What sets that apart?
Well, again, that's sort of like, it's, you know, I mean, Uma Thurman's a perfectly fine actress, but to write a whole biography of her, I mean, I sort of get it. Obviously, you know, I mean, you could write a great, and people have, you know, great biography of Greta Garbo or, you know, Katharine Hepburn, or even, you know, somebody contemporary with a lot of, you know, stuff under her belt, like Meryl Streep, say. Or I get it, you know, you write a biography of like Kim Kardashian. You know, I mean, that's like, who cares? But, you know, that's going to have an audience that's going to sell.
Including my daughter, who's Kardashian groupie. I mean, it's a big part of the culture in its way.
Yeah, exactly. But then Uma Thurman, it's just kind of like, she's kind of neither here nor there. But like somebody devoted a whole, I forget if the you know, it's like a 250-page biography.
I think you
say
here,
index, you know, yeah.
You say here, 289-page life of,
yes,
Uma Thurman, including index.
Yeah, including an index. Like, who's looking up the, you know, like, who's looking up the Uma Thurman index?
All right, here are two of my favorites, Bruce.
Yeah.
The Complete Bean Cookbook by Victor Bennett. And this one has, on top of its sort of expected boredom,
yeah,
it has a special Philip.
Well, exactly, because I would think normally I would probably not include the Complete Bean Cookbook in my collection of boring books. One, because I actually happen to like beans. I'm a big legume fan. Seriously, you know, chickpeas are
well, you're
are
a fava bean guy.
Yeah, fava bean, exactly. And then also, you know, it's kind of, the bean cookbook. It's, you know, that we all know what the sort of obvious humor of that is. So that felt like too easy. But this particular bean cookbook, on the cover it says, including an homage to the bean by Senator Everett M. Dirksen. I mean, again, it's like an homage to the bean. I mean, you know, even as a bean lover, like, an homage to the bean? And then by Everett Dirksen? Like, that's the last name you would expect to come after that. I mean,
So there's a kind of genius to that one.
Exactly. Well, again, I think I use the phrase as sort of exquisitely boring, which I think that probably defines it right there.
And how about Herbert Hoover, American Quaker?
Well, again, it's sort of like, it's, you know, again, it's like any Herbert Hoover biography you'd probably include, you know, but again, maybe it'd be too easy. But then when it's like American Quaker, it's, you know, it's focusing on his Quakerism. Again, the more it reaches this sort of sublime level of boredom, I think. And I say that as somebody with a kid at a friend's school, too. So, but
the most boring aspect of a highly boring man.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe it could have been, you know, Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce.
Okay. So now we have to ask you the tough question here.
Yes.
These books are exquisitely, sublimely boring. You collect them. Do you ever read them? Do you read little portions of them? I mean, in other words, do they have to prove textually that they're just as boring as their covers would indicate?
You know, I wish I could say I was more rigorous about this hobby than I am. But no, I mean, this is totally judging books by their covers, which I know we're never supposed to do. But that's totally it. I've sort of skimmed them a little bit. I was kind of curious about Hope for Man. And it's all very much, you know, written in the shadow of the H-bomb. And it's actually in some ways kind of evocative of its time. And so probably maybe the actual text is in some ways maybe more interesting, at least as sort of looking at a cultural moment than – so no. Anyways, what I'm saying, yeah, no, this is just totally judging books by their covers. And there's a – I did read like – I skimmed a little – I have another book, Sailor the Salmon. And it's a novel about a salmon. I think it – you know, I didn't read the whole thing. I think it sort of follows his whole spawning trip, and I think he meets an otter or, you know, something like that. But I did sort of skim around, and I found a dirty part at the end because he is going to spawn, and this great there's this great line: the sight of the eggs and the taste of the water made Sailor quiver. His milt flowed from him in a mist.
Well,
which I love that. It's like the Sailor Salmon version of what, like page 27 on The Godfather or whatever it was.
Well, you also read or at least looked at John Steinbeck's foreword to Adlai Stevenson's Speeches.
Yeah, well, which
and
was
quote a choice line.
Well, which is interesting, yeah, because Steinbeck actually admits at the beginning of this thing, and this is written in 1952, when right after Stevenson has been nominated as the Democratic nominee for president, you know, an election he would lose to Dwight Eisenhower. But yeah, basically, you know, Steinbeck begins his intro saying, "A year and a half ago, I'd never heard of Mr. Stevenson," which, you know, again, yeah, you just really, yeah, that's just really launching you into this subject. I don't think it's, yeah, in the great Steinbeck works, I don't think it goes in his, you know, American Library editions.
So how big is your collection at this point?
Sadly, my collection is limited to the 8 books which appeared which appear on the back page of the book review. As soon as I had reached critical mass, which I guess I felt was 8, I hurried them over to you to do a story. So, but my collection will go on. I still continue to look, and I'm so grateful for your having published my essay about this, because it was a real, you know, I started this collection, I guess, I think 2 years ago. My wife and children just made incredible fun of me. Like, why are you collecting boring books? Really, they just thought it was kind of, you know, sort of some paternal idiocy on my part. But when I sent the essay in and you guys said you wanted to publish it, it was a great moment of triumph for me at home. You know, it was kind of like, in your face, kids, you know, see, somebody's interested in this.
But there's also hope, though, for the boring authors of our own moment. I mean, they may make their way to your...
Oh,
well,
yes,
collection.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I would hope to get more. I would hope to get more contemporary works in there, and I hope, you know, as a someday to be published author myself, I certainly hope I'm not in, you know, somebody else's boring book collection in, you know, the later half of the century or something like that.
Thanks a lot, Bruce.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Bruce Handy, deputy editor at Vanity Fair, who wrote this week's back page essay, "My Fabulous Boring Book Collection." Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
So, Greg, what's new on the list this post-holiday week?
Well, post-holiday is the operative term there. On the fiction side of things, we have two different books set on Nantucket or a Nantucket-like island. One of them is Ellen Hildebrand's book Summerland, which is new on the list at number 4. Hildebrand lives on Nantucket and comes out every summer with a book set there. She's an interesting case because she writes these very popular, very successful sort of romance novels set on Nantucket. She also is a MFA graduate from the University of Iowa, where she had a writing fellowship and a teaching fellowship there.
So she was at the Writer's Workshop.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And she's just fallen into this series of Nantucket books that sell very well. The other book that doesn't name Nantucket as its setting, but it's pretty unmistakably set on Nantucket, is a debut novel by a woman named Maggie Shipstead called Seating Arrangements that is kind of a domestic comedy about a wedding that takes place on Nantucket and all the problems in the family that's gathering for the wedding there.
You know, Greg, even a slow-minded guy like me will have a really bold idea like once a decade. I think I've got one. I'm going to try to write one of these books and set it on Martha's Vineyard.
Hey, there you go.
What else have we got?
Also new on the fiction list this week, we've got James Rollins with a new novel in his Sigma Force series called Bloodline. That's new on the list at number 3. Karen Thompson Walker's debut novel, The Age of Miracles, is new on the list at number 6.
This one's getting a lot of attention.
Random House reportedly paid $1 million for it, and it's also had huge overseas sales. England, I think, paid another $1 million, and it's had strong foreign sales in Germany and Italy and other places. Walker is a former editor at Simon & Schuster, and so she's very well connected in the industry. This is her first novel, and it is sort of a quiet coming-of-age domestic story set against an apocalypse caused by the slowing of the Earth's rotation, which is making the oceans rise. And it sort of takes this concept of the slowing of the Earth's revolution and uses it as global warming or something. It's just that it's this undeniable, as the Earth is slowing its spinning, there are freak natural occurrences all over, and the end of the world will come, and we all know it, and it's how we will adjust to that. It's drawing comparisons to Tom Perata's Leftovers, another domestic novel set against a supernatural occurrence.
And where the supernatural occurrence becomes a kind of metaphor for other themes that the novelist explores?
That's exactly right. It's getting pretty mixed reviews, actually. Our review hasn't appeared yet. It will. We're planning to run a review of it. But in the Daily Times, Michiko Kakutani gave it a very favorable review. She compared it favorably to The Leftovers. She thought The Leftovers didn't work as well as this book does. But in the Washington Post, their fiction critic Ron Charles really hated this book. He found it very pedestrian, and he compared it unfavorably to The Leftovers, which he thought was a knockout success.
So The Leftovers has become the gold standard by which we measure domestic apocalyptic novels.
There you go.
Good going, Tom Perata.
Finally, on the fiction list, there is another new title. Jess Walters' new novel, Beautiful Ruins, is on the list at number 15. That is sort of a movie world equivalent to Jenny Egan's Visit from the Goon Squad, which was set in the music industry. Both books look at an aging industry figure who was once very powerful and has now lost some of his cachet. They look at his young female assistant, and they spiral outward from those central characters to go back into the past, see how they made their careers. In Beautiful Ruins, it's a movie producer who now does reality TV shows and who got his start as a young publicist working on Cleopatra, the movie with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, and managing some of the scandals on there and spinning the scandals out to turn the movie into a big success. It's gotten very strong reviews. Walter's a very good literary kind of pop writer. He tackles big contemporary themes with really sharp prose, a lot of energy in these books. And I think this book is selling well on the strength of some strong reviews. Then on the nonfiction side of things, Edward Klein's The Amateur is finally knocked out of the number one spot by Cheryl Strayed's Wild, which, of course, is the pick of the new Oprah Book Club. I believe it's Wild's first time at number one, despite being on the list for 11 weeks now. There are three new titles on the nonfiction list. New at number seven is Marcus Samuelson's Yes, Chef. Samuelson is a celebrity chef from Sweden. He was born in Ethiopia, but he was adopted young by a Swedish family, and he grew up in Sweden. At number eight, new on the list, is a book called Becoming Sister Wives. That's by the stars of the TLC reality show Sister Wives. It's Cody Brown and his four wives, Mary, Janelle, Christine, and Robin Brown. Are you familiar with this show?
I watch a lot of reality TV. Seem to have missed this one.
It is basically the story of a polygamist family. It's Cody Brown and his four wives, Mary, Janelle, Christine, and Robin Brown.
Are these Mormons?
They are members of an offshoot of Mormonism. They are the Apostolic United Brethren. They're not officially affiliated with the Latter-day Saints, the mainstream Mormon. So no. They did live in Utah for the first season. They've since moved to Las Vegas. And
they've moved to Las Vegas?
Yes, that's right. They've been investigated for violating the laws against polygamy, but only one of the marriages is an officially sanctioned legal marriage. The others are quote-unquote spiritual marriages. They have 17 kids among them.
They weren't investigated in Las Vegas, were they? I mean, aren't there other vices you might look into in Las Vegas apart from having big families?
So this is a book that just kind of goes behind the scenes of that show and behind the scenes of those marriages to look at that polygamous family.
To look at the condition of normal American everyday life.
And then finally new on the list at number nine is Riel Hunter's memoir, What Really Happened. Hunter, of course, is the mistress of John Edwards, who had his child and led to his trial for possible campaign fraud.
And also the inspiration for one of Jay McInerney's early novels.
That's right. The central character in The Story of My Life was modeled on Riel Hunter.
Who I believe had been a girlfriend of McInerney's.
I believe you're right.
Can we slander anybody else, Jocelyn? Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.